You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2012 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother Darren Guy on the subject, Wrestling with Jacob. This class is titled, With the House of Esau.
Morning, everybody. Kids back?
Yeah,
thank you. Wide awake? Oh, there will be in a minute, right. I think there'll be less jokes in this session. Not because I've run out. But this session, we're dealing with Jacob's wrestlings with the house of Esau, as opposed to Esau himself. We're going forward, really, in history now, in this session. We're going to talk about the relationships between the house of Jacob and the house of Esau. And unfortunately, that means trouble and strife. Perhaps if you first come with me to Genesis 35. I know I mentioned it yesterday, but from my following of the scriptures, it seems to me, although there may be other occurrences, that there's only two recorded comings together of Jacob and Esau. They being, first of all, if we recall, when there are 400 men on the other side of the hill and they came together and embraced. The second one is at the death of their father. Genesis 35. And Jacob came, verse 27, sorry. And Jacob came unto Isaac his father, unto Mamre, unto the city of Arba, which is in Hebron, where Abram and Isaac journeyed. And the days of Isaac were 180 years, and Isaac gave up the ghost, gave up the spirit, and died, and was gathered unto his people, being old and full of days, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. They had the grace of brothers, both sons of a father, to come together in their mutual grief to give their father the due respect. It makes me wonder, really, particularly of Esau, as to what really was going through his mind. I do wonder sometimes, even though the scriptures don't tell us so, whether he had any faith at all. The scriptures sort of suggest that there was none. But I would like to think, with the upbringing that he had, with the father and mother and grandfather and grandmother that he had, at the very least there was an understanding of the promises of God unto Abraham and to Isaac, and unfortunately for Esau now unto Jacob. The decisions that each of us make in our lives, however big and small, sometimes might have long-term consequences. Not even necessarily for ourselves. The decisions that we make might have long-term consequences for our children, our grandchildren. Now, whilst Esau and Jacob, it seems, came together in relative peace, the long-term consequences were considerable. There's a verse I'd just like you to go to, I think we ought to go to it, in Deuteronomy 23. I was going to quote it, but I'd like you to see it. You might want to mark it, I don't know. But Deuteronomy 23. Historically speaking, the relations between Jacob's house and Esau's house are to mean trouble and strife and warfare and death and misery. But there's a verse which is quite surprising in this chapter, which we must remember as well. Deuteronomy 23, verse 7. Thou shalt not abhor an Edomite. That's the house of Esau. Thou shalt not abhor an Edomite, for he is thy brother. A number of years ago in sunny Halifax, that's the proper one in England, I went to a garden centre. I always want to know where, as some of you have spotted this week, I always want to know where people are from, pick up their accents, and I recognised JFK yesterday. I worked out exactly where somebody was from, just from the accent. And I was in a garden centre just outside Halifax, and I said to this gentleman, who I could tell was of Eastern origin, around the Israel area, I said, where are you from? He says, I'm from Palestine. That's interesting. He says, why is that? I said, there's no such place. I said, does that mean that you're a Jew? As you see, I'm not afraid to start a conversation. I wouldn't do it in New Jersey, though. I'm not that daft. He says, no, I'm not a Jew. I said, but you're from Israel then? Well, I'm from Palestine. I said, yes, but you're from the place which is now called Israel. Well, yes. I said, so you're a Palestinian then? He says, yes. I said, don't you find it interesting that the Jewish scriptures say, thou shalt not abhor the Edomite? Does it? I said, has no Jew ever told you that? She says, no. I said, don't you find it strange that in some of the Old Testament prophecies, some of the Arab nations in the time of the end are going to receive a blessing? Does it? I said, yeah, it does. They never told you that. Oh, he said, that's interesting. I said, why is that? He says, because in the Quran, it says that the Jews are going to receive a blessing at the time of the end. I said, oh, that's interesting. I said, have you ever told a Jew that? He says, no. I said, wouldn't it be good if Jews and Arabs remembered who their brothers were and read their scriptures? However, the account with regards to Jacob and a certain line of the house of Esau was to be trouble and strife, and if only certain men who were given positions of authority had shown their authority as Jews, the troubles would have ended a lot sooner. Let's sing a hymn now, and you'll understand the context. It's one of my favourite hymns, even though I know one or two people aren't particularly keen on it. It's Pray for the Peace of Jerusalem. Hymn 61 in the green hymn book. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. They that prosper, they shall prosper that love thee. Thank you. Back to Genesis again, if you will, then, please. Back to the end of those verses we looked at, chapter 35. The scriptures are regularly not a chronological record, which is, I think, designed to make us work harder and dig more, and to try and piece it all together. However, I do find it interesting, when we come to the end of chapter 35, we have the death of Isaac there, and Esau and Jacob being together. And immediately we're then thrust into what we would call chapter 36. Because the chapter divisions were not there originally. Which to me is speaking out as though it's like saying, now that Isaac is dead, Esau is going to do what he really wants to do. Now that Isaac is dead, the hopes and the aspirations of Jacob are even more important as to how they're focused and to where the line of the blessing is going to come from. We'll come to that in a minute. So we come here to chapter 36. Now these are the generations of Esau, who is Edom. And the whole of the chapter, brethren who are speakers, I wonder if you'd like to put your hands up if you've ever spoken on Genesis 36. All right, then by contrast, put your hands up if you've ever spoken on Genesis 37. I was sure to speak a bit more. Oh, yeah, yeah, so some hands are going up. I've never met anybody who's spoken on Genesis 36. And I think quite simply, here's the exhortation. Chapter 36 is a list of all of these people. This is me, I'm Esau, I'm the man, look at me! I've got dukes here, I've got kings here, I've got power here. Never mind the blessings. I don't need to get baptized because I'll go and make a lot of money instead. That's how some people live their lives. That because they're hiding from the decision they have not made, they justify it by making another course of action. Forgive me if I've trodden on your toes, but we're talking about Esau here. I've messed up with Dad. I've messed up with Granddad. I've not got the blessings. I've not got the birthright. So I'll go out and I'll spread my seed all over the place, and I'll be powerful. And I'll be more powerful than my brother Jacob. And that's what chapter 36 is saying. Look at it. Esau took wives of the daughters of Canaan, whom Abraham said, do not marry. Whom Isaac said, and his wife said, do not marry. Ada, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and Aholibamah, the daughter of Anna, the daughter of Zibeon the Hivite. Just put your hands up at any time if you want me to slow down, if you can't understand. And Bashemath, Ishmael's daughter, sister of Naboth. It's just realigning, reaffirming the nature of the man. If dad says go east, I'll go west. Verse 6. And Esau took his wives, and his sons, and his daughters, and all the persons of his house, Septuagint says, all of his slaves, everything of his power, and his cattle, and his, all his beasts, and all his substance, which he had got in the land of Canaan. He got in the land where dad lived, and he takes everything out. Whereas Jacob, by faith, got nothing in the land where dad lived, gets it outside of Syria, and brings it back home. You know, I heard a story, in fact I have to be careful how I put this, because you might know him, but there was a gentleman before my time who lived not far from me, and he'd had enough of Christadelphians. And he needed to get away from Christadelphia, if there's such a phrase. So he thought, well, I'll go far, far away. And instead of being in sunny Yorkshire, he went to sunny South Africa. And he moved into his house in sunny South Africa. And he got comfortable, miles away from Christadelphia. And he went to have a chat with his next door neighbour, who says, by the way, I'm a Christadelphian, nice to meet you. It's a bit like the story of Jonah, isn't it? He's now in America, a brother. If you run, God will never leave you. Well, that's not strictly true. As he says to the children of Israel, because thou hast forsaken me, I will forsake you. But if we have him in our heart, he will never, never leave us. Kids, think of the decisions you're going to make. But Esau, he might have been friendly with his father and to a degree with his brother, but the rest that follow are bitter and twisted and want rid of the house of Jacob. And which he got in the land of Canaan and went into the country from the face of his brother Jacob. He leaves his brother. And there's a good excuse here in verse 7. For their riches were more than that they might dwell together, and the land wherein they were strangers could not bear them because of their cattle. I'm not criticizing the scriptures. I'm not doubting the scriptures. But do you think if Jacob and Esau, as good twins, as loving brothers, as men of equal faith, do you think if they were, they would have separated? They couldn't cope being in one another's company. And they used their riches and their cattle and their lack of land as a reason for not meeting together again. Maybe it was for the best. Thus, verse 8, Esau dwelt in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. Just reading on. These are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites in Mount Seir. These are the names of Esau's sons. Eliphaz, the son of Ada, the wife of Esau. Reuel, the son of Bashemath, the wife of Esau. And the sons of Eliphaz, so we've got Esau and Eliphaz, and then the first son is Teman. Teman is mentioned elsewhere in Scripture, and is also mentioned in the Quran. Because Teman means of the south. Teman is now, or has been for many, many, many years, one of the three holy cities in the Islamic faith. Mecca, Medina, and whatever the other one is. Teman is Medina in the south. It means from the south. These are the names of Esau's sons, Eliphaz. Verse 11. The sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. And Timnah was concubine to Eliphaz. He's diluting any potential line of faith even further. And it happens in the household of faith as well. Do you remember what happened to Gideon? Gideon, that tremendous man of faith in Judges 6, 7, 8, whatever it is. And he had many wives. And he had 70 sons. One of which was son of a concubine. And he, through the anguish of his soul, because of the nature that he found himself, a place that he found himself in, once dad was dead, conspired to have all of the rest of his brothers murdered. The knife was twisting in his heart and he couldn't cope with it. And he used it and he lost it. It came to his own end, didn't he? Anyway, but Timnah was concubine to Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bare to Eliphaz Amalek. Now there's something, a couple of things that we need to bear in mind about the household of Esau, that whilst it's very difficult when we're looking at the map to say who's which nation, isn't it? Because they all change. But what we've just read in that verse is that the house of Esau splits because of a concubine. And through Timnah, and through Amalek, Amalek was of course not quite the same as all the other brothers, because he was the son of a concubine. So the other brothers don't particularly look that kindly on Eliphaz either. So, on Amalek rather. So beware Amalek. Beware that strain of the house of Esau. Because when you go into battle and it gets difficult, the brothers of yours who are the Muslims now, when it really comes to the crunch, when you look round, you'll be stood by yourself. That's what the scriptures teach. That's what the prophecy against Esau is teaching. That at the time of the end, when you wish to have the house of Jacob destroyed, your brothers who wish to support you and encourage you in the battle, when you turn round, they've gone. And you will be annihilated. We know the name Amalek. The king ultimately, the man, the name who will become king of the Amalekites was Agag. Now Agag is a title. It's a bit like Pharaoh in Egypt, or Caesar in Rome, or Elizabeth in Canada. Right? It is a king which bears a title for future kings to come. But we'll come back to that point later. Come with me now to Ezekiel 35. Ezekiel chapter 35. Prophecies against the household of Esau through Mount Seir, where they lived. We'll read quite a bit of this. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Son of man, set thy face against Mount Seir, and prophesy against it, and say unto it, Thus saith the Lord God, Behold, O Mount Seir, I am against thee, and I will stretch out mine hand against thee, and I will make thee most desolate. I will lay thy cities waste, and thou shalt be desolate, and thou shalt know that I am Yahweh, I am the Lord, because thou hast had a perpetual hatred. It's not one that just lasted in the days of Esau and Jacob. It's gone on and on and on. And I do not like it, says God. It is a perpetual hatred. You will not let it lie. And I shed the blood of the children of Israel by the force of the sword. Remember what Isaac said to Jacob, to Esau in his blessing? By thy sword shalt thou live. In the time of their calamity, in the time of their iniquity, had an end. The time of their calamity? The time of whose calamity? The time of the Jews' calamity. The time of the calamity of the Jews, when Babylon would come in and butcher many. Where was the house of Esau, the brothers? Were they helping? The household of Esau did worse than not help. They encouraged the Babylonians to butcher as many Jews as possible. We'll come back to that in a bit. What happened in the AD 70? Who was it that was stirring up Rome to pull down the temple? It was the house of Esau. In the early 30s, who was it that was speaking to Adolf Hitler when he first came into power to come up with a solution to annihilate the Jews? It was a Muslim cleric. I've forgotten his name now. You can find it on the internet. destroy, you've got to wipe them out. And it's perpetual hatred. Therefore, verse 6, as I live, saith the Lord God, I will prepare thee unto blood, and blood shall pursue thee. Since thou hast hated blood, or because you have not hated blood, even blood shall pursue thee. Thus will I make Mount Seir most desolate, and cut off from it him that passeth out and him that returneth. And I will fill his mountains with his slain men. In thy hills and in thy valleys and in thy rivers shall they fall that are slain with a sword. I will make thee perpetual desolations, and thy city shall not return, and ye shall know that I am the Lord. All we need for peace, never mind the Lord's return, brethren, sisters and young people, all we need for peace in 2012, it's quite simple. Peace in the Middle East is an absolute piece of cake, as we say in England. All it takes is this one little point. Israel, denounce their God and accept Allah. That's all they need. If Israel reject their God and turn to Allah, as Muhammad encouraged them and wanted them to do in the 4th century AD, then there will be no trouble in the Middle East. But it will not happen. And that is why those people are not just against the Jews. They are against the God of the Jews. That's what it's really about. Because, verse 10, speaking to Esau's house, because thou hast said, these two nations and these two countries shall be mine, and we will possess it. Remember what the statement was when their mother was pregnant? Two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people will come forth from thy bowels. And you have said, Esau, that we want it all. I have given you, Esau, the land of Edom, the Edomites, the Mount Seir, and all the other places. And I have given you, Israel, your special place. Therefore, as I live, verse 11, saith the Lord God, I will do according to thine anger and according to thine envy which thou hast used out of thy hatred, your anger, your envy, your hatred against them, and I will make myself known among them when I have judged thee. And thou shalt know that I am the Lord, and I have heard all thy blasphemies which thou hast spoken against the mountains of Israel, saying, they are laid desolate, they are given to us to consume. Thus with your mouth ye have boasted against me, and have multiplied your words against me, and I have heard them. It's not against the Jews. It's against the God who is the creator of the heavens and the earth and all things therein. You have boasted against me. Verse 15. As thou didst rejoice at the inheritance of the house of Israel, because it was desolate, because Babylon came in and butchered it and laid it waste, because you've rejoiced, so will I do unto thee. Thou shalt be desolate, O Mount Seir, and all Idumea, even all of it. And ultimately they shall know that I am the Lord. Come back with me now then, brothers and sisters, young people, to Deuteronomy chapter 2. Let's see the historical record as we go through. It goes back to the days, well it goes further back of course, doesn't it? But the historical context is in the days of Moses. They've left Egypt, they're in great difficulty. They're wandering the wilderness for 40 years and they're trying to get to the promised land. And because of their sin, because of their iniquity, it's taking them 40 years. But they're now on their way. They're now ready to go there, and they want to pass through. God has told them, go through the King's Highway. The road that is, if we have Israel here, and we have Moab, and where the Edomites live here, just under the outskirts of the borders of it, going way down to the south, is the well-known place called the King's Highway. And it goes through Petra. But bear that in mind, we might get to Obadiah later. It's the places where the Edomites dwell. And that's the place, says God, that I want you to get there. And, of course, they wouldn't be allowed. Deuteronomy 2, verse 1. Then we turned and took our journey into the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea, as the Lord spake unto me, and we compassed Mount Seir many days. And the Lord spake unto me, saying, ye have compassed this mountain long enough, turn you northward, and command thou the people, saying, ye are to pass through the coast of your brethren, the children of Esau, which dwell in Seir, and they shall be afraid of you. Take ye good heed unto yourselves, therefore. Meddle not with them, for I will not give you their land, no, not so much as a foot breadth, because I have given it to Mount Seir unto Esau for a possession. I have given them their land, and they should stay there. And you should remember that. Ye shall buy meat of them for money. Don't pinch it. Don't outstay your welcome. They are your brothers, but they have a living to earn. They need their keep. And ye shall also buy water of them for money, that ye may drink. For the Lord thy God hath blessed thee in all the works of thy hand. He knoweth all thy walking through this great wilderness, these 40 years. The Lord thy God hath been with thee. Thou hast lacked nothing. And when we passed by from our brethren, the children of Esau, which dwelt in Seir, through the way of the plain, through Elath, and from Ezion-Geber, we turned and passed by the way of the wilderness of Moab. Numbers 20. Moving on. Numbers chapter 20. We see there what happens. Numbers chapter 20, verse 14. And Moses sent messengers from Kadesh unto the king of Edom. Thus saith thy brother Israel, Jacob. It's playing the peace card. You know, he is your brother. We are your brethren. We're not just a foreign nation, we have the same root. Thou knowest all the travail that have befallen us, how our fathers went down into Egypt, and we have dwelt in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians vexed us and our fathers, and when we cried unto the Lord, he heard our voice and sent an angel and hath brought us forth out of Egypt, and behold, we are in Kadesh, a city in the uttermost of thy border. Let us, I pray thee, pass through thy country. Let us pass, I pray thee, through thy country. We will not pass through the fields or the vineyards, neither will we drink of the water of the wells. We will go by the king's highway, the motorway, the straight road, the simple road. We will not turn to the right hand nor to the left until we have passed thy borders. And Edom said unto him, thou shalt not pass by me, lest I come out against thee with a sword. A request of peace, a request of peaceful passage, and once again the sword comes out. And the children of Israel said unto him, we'll go by the highway, and if I and my cattle drink of thy water, then I will pay for it. I will only, without doing anything else, go through on my feet. And he said, thou shalt not go through. And Edom came out against him with much people and with a strong hand. And Edom refused to give Israel passage through the border. And elsewhere, if we go to Exodus 17, we won't. If we go to Deuteronomy 25, God says, if that's the way they're going to treat you, if that's the way they're treating me, then I will utterly, utterly destroy them. Now, we all remember who the first king of Israel is, don't we? Do we?
Yes.
Which tribe was he from?
Benjamin.
Benjamin. Okay. What's Benjamin mean?
Son of the right hand.
Son of the right hand. What does that mean? Well, I think it means a couple of things. If you remember the context, Rachel had just died. She called him in her travail of her giving birth, Benoni, son of my sorrow. And she dies there in childbirth. She calls him Benoni, and for the first time, the man Jacob stands up and says, no, I'm going to name this son. All the others were named by her, or Leah, or Bilhah, or Zilpah. And we get to Benjamin, or Benoni, and he says, no, they'll be son of my right hand. This lad is not going to leave my right hand side at all. I've lost Joseph, the firstborn of Rachel. He's gone. He is not. This lad's staying here with me. But it becomes, the son of the right hand means, this is a man of strength. And the Benjamites became renowned for their fighting capacity. The Benjamites were the most fearsome of all of the tribes of Israel when it came to battle. And if we had a problem, we send in the Benjamites first. And I ask the question again, and you now know the answer. Who was the first king of Israel? Saul. And what tribe was he of? He was a Benjamite. And was he a little chap? He was a big chap. Right, we're building up the picture a bit. Should he be frightened of a foreigner? Son of the right hand, 6 foot something, strong as anything. Why would he be a wimp? No need to be. What's the first task that he's given? Come with me to 1 Samuel 15. 1 Samuel chapter 15. This passage, I've heard over the years many a brother or sister question, as we should, question what on earth God is doing here. Why would God or Samuel be so harsh on Saul because he refuses, or he seemingly refuses, to fully commit to the command which he's been asked to do? What was he asked to do? Destroy Amalek. Not quite Amalek, but everything to do with Amalek. 1 Samuel 15, verse 1. Samuel also said unto Saul, "The Lord sent me to anoint thee to be king over his people, over Israel. Now therefore, hearken unto the voice of the words of the Lord. Thus saith the Lord of hosts, I remember that which Amalek did to Israel, how he laid wait for him in the way when he came up from Egypt." They didn't just say, "No, you can't come through." They did everything they possibly could to make it difficult for Israel, as they did in the days of Babylon, which we might get to, we might not. "Now go and smite Amalek, and utterly destroy all that they have, and spare them not, but slay both man and woman, infant and suckling, ox and sheep, camel and ass." What a vicious, cruel, horrible God, many might say. Why would God ask that of his first king? Because Amalek, his raison d'etre for his nation, was the utter annihilation and destruction of God's people and the name of Yahweh. That was his whole reason in life. It wasn't God being unkind to him. It's God saying, "I will preserve my people for all time." And what does he do? Verse 7. "And Saul smote the Amalekites from Havilah until thou comest to Shur, that is over against Egypt. And he took Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag, and the best of the sheep, and of the oxen, of the fatlings, of the lambs, and all that was good, and would not," not did not, he would not utterly destroy them. He had it within him. He was a Benjamite. We've already seen in the verse he was a butcher. But he would not utterly destroy the Amalekites. "Because thou hast rejected the word of the Lord, I have rejected thee. Because you have not hearkened unto the voice of the Lord, I have rejected thee. To obey is better than sacrifice." Why did you keep the best of the ox and the sheep back? "Well, we thought they might be good for sacrifices." "No, I don't want the Amalekite sheep and oxen. I want a willing heart. I want the right attitude. A man after God's own heart. David who would come." And they did not destroy. Come with me now, if you will, to Lamentations 4. We'll move on in history. Lamentations chapter 4, which is just after Jeremiah. I'm sure you know that. I'm giving you a 10-minute warning. We might, I doubt it, but we might get to Obadiah. All right? Okay? And if we don't get to Obadiah, you can read it at your leisure. Obadiah chapter 4. So Lamentations is written by the man Jeremiah, who has observed, the young man Jeremiah, who has observed all the difficulty that's gone on with the Babylonians coming in and butchering and annihilating all the Jews, or many of the Jews, and taking back to captivity and doing this, that and the other, and destroying the temple. Why did they destroy the temple? That was not the Babylonians' normal way of doing things. If you'd invaded a land, I don't know, such as a city in England, let's say your country invaded, or some country invaded London, would they pull down and the Houses of Parliament? They'd keep it and use it for their own benefit, because they'd say, "This is ours now." So why did the Babylonians pull down the temple? Because the house of Esau encouraged them to do it. It was their words to the armies of Babylon that encouraged them to do it. Lamentations 4, though, verse 21. "Rejoice," it's irony. I don't know whether you do irony in America, or you might say irony or something, I don't know, but it's irony. Pardon? I still can't get it. It's a bit like Darren, it's one of those words you'll never say properly. "Rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom. You be happy at what you've seen happen to my nation as he's lamenting over everything that's gone on. You lot, rejoice and be glad, O daughter of Edom, that dwellest in the land of Uz. The cup also shall pass through unto thee. Thou shalt be drunken and thou shalt make thyself naked. What we've got, the little cup of pain and anguish and 70 years of captivity, what we've got, we've tasted of that cup of woe. You're going to get drunk on that cup of woe. That's what it's saying. You're going to drink so much of it that you're going to be utterly ashamed and made naked. The punishment of thine iniquity is accomplished, O daughter of Zion. The captivity is coming to an end. He will no more carry thee away into captivity. He will visit thine iniquity, O daughter of Edom. He will discover thy sins. We know, says Jeremiah, through God, through Jeremiah, we know what you were doing. Now Psalm 137. This is a Psalm 137 paints a horrible picture of what was going on. Psalm 137. I remember as a youngster being at the Swanwick gathering. I know there are a couple of lads at the top who go to the Swanwick gathering in England. And when you're 13 or 14 and you go to a service and you're listening in a very formal fashion at the Swanwick gathering, it's chilled out a bit now, but there you go. I'm on the committee now. I remember going and not understanding a word, really, and I remember the reading for that day must have been Psalm 137, and I'm minding my own business like a teenager does up there, pretending they're listening, and suddenly I heard read out there, by the rivers of Babylon, there we wept. I think, hang on a minute, that's Boney M. Anybody remember? By the rivers of Babylon, where we sat down. Yeah, okay. Cool, you're not as confident as I thought you were. Right, if you want singing, come tonight. Well, that's what it's all about. By the rivers of Babylon, it doesn't mean rivers. When you look at your maps in the back of your Bible, when you think of rivers in Babylon, you think of Euphrates, for example. It doesn't mean that. It means the canals. By those little tiny estuaries and canals that you can't see when you look at the map. We weren't allowed by the Euphrates. Us Jews would spoil the Euphrates. We wouldn't be allowed anywhere in there. By the little estuaries where you were unseen, were kept out of the way, there we wept. We sat down and we wept when we remembered Zion. We'd been taken out. We hanged our harps upon the willows in the midst thereof. You know how the Jews loved their music and their harmonies and the beautiful singing? They hung their harps on the willows. You can't sing when your heart's as heavy as that. For there they that carried us away, captive, required of us a song. Go on. Sing us one of your little happy songs. It's like Adolf Hitler in Poland, taking away all the classical pianists who were the international performers and starving them and then saying, go on, play us a tune. That's what Jerusalem have gone through time after time, what Israel have gone through time after time after time. And they that wasted us required of us mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. Go on, let's hear one of your nice songs. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? If I forget thee, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget a cunning. I might never see Jerusalem ever again. But if I forget that, take everything away from me that I hold dear. I must remember Jerusalem. Next year in Jerusalem. Next year in Jerusalem. If I do not remember thee, let my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth, if I prefer not Jerusalem above my chief joy. I might never see Jerusalem ever again, but let it be the top of my joy. Remember, O Lord, the children of Edom in the day of Jerusalem who said, raise it, even to the foundation. It was the Edomites that told Babylon to pull down the temple. It was the Edomites that told them to burn it. It was the Edomites that encouraged them as much as possible to make it a waste. O daughter of Babylon, who art to be destroyed. Such a mighty kingdom. Thousands of miles, about 3,000 miles across, which we think is big. From Ethiopia right across to India. That's such a massive kingdom. In 70 years like that, it's gone. And Israel still exists. We won't go to it, but we've already mentioned about Saul being a Benjamite and Amalek being of the house of Agag being an Amalekite, therefore being from Esau. And Saul did not get rid of them all, did he? And then we come towards the time of the end of this 70-year captivity, and we come to a little book called Esther. Jewish name, Hadassah. You get better news than we do about certain parts of the Middle East, but did you hear about the worm that was planted in the Iranian missile system? Did you hear that? So as soon as any weapon, this is how I understand it, as soon as any weapon from Iran was aimed at Israel, the worm cut in and the system crashed. And when they observed the worm that was in the computer system, it was named. And the name of it was Hadassah, Myrtle. Esther is the Persian name. So when we come to the book of Esther, and Haman is promoted to the right hand of the king Ahasuerus. And bluntly, Mordecai refuses to show him any reverence, which is not normally the right way to behave. Why did he refuse to show him any reverence? What nationality was Mordecai? He was a Jew. What tribe was he? He was a Benjamite. He was a mighty warrior. He had memories that went back, way back. Haman, the Agagite. Mordecai refuses to bow the knee or show any praise unto Haman because he knows, irrespective of what happens, now that Haman is there, he will want, what were the words? The utter destruction, effectively, and annihilation of all the Jews, infant and old people and young people and ox and ass and anything they've got, utterly destroy. Only they will take a spoil. They will take a spoil. And God says, or Mordecai says to Esther, and the message is passed to all the 127 provinces of the whole of the powerful kingdom of Medo-Persia. You will utterly destroy all the children of Haman, but do not take a spoil, not like Saul did. In the Septuagint, in Numbers 24, the word Gog is replaced with Agag. Look at that. There's a connection with the time of the end, with the Edomites, not just Russia. Let's come to Psalm 83, brothers and sisters. We will come to an end. As we've said and shown to a degree, that this wrestling of Esau with Jacob, or this wrestling of Jacob with Esau, happened in their lifetime. By the way, was that the bell? I'm so sensitive to speaking longer than a bell. I wasn't sure if it was a piece of cutlery dropped or a bell. Psalm 83. Keep not thou silence, O God. Hold not thy peace, and be not still, O God. For lo, thine enemies. Remember that at all times. It's not just the enemies of the Jews. It's God's enemies. They want his name utterly removing from the face of the earth. For lo, thine enemies make a tumult, and they that hate thee have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against thee, against thy people, and consulted against thy hidden ones. Some suggest the name Esther means hidden. They have taken crafty counsel. They have said, come, and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. This isn't just a story, an account of what went on. This is a prophecy as well. It is a perpetual hatred that will not go away until we won't turn to it, because the same thing comes up in Obadiah's prophecy. Thou that sit in the clefts of the rock, you live in Petra, you live in the places of power and strength. It ends with, saviours will come. For they have consulted together with one consent. You know probably just as well as any other nation in the world about the different factions of Islamic terror. how you have Hamas and Hezbollah, for example, and others, but those are the two main ones. And Hamas and Hezbollah absolutely detest one another. They are completely different factions, and they are fighting against each other, metaphorically speaking. They hate one another. But before his death, a man you have all heard of, Osama bin Laden, said, "There is only one thing that Hamas and Hezbollah should be united for. That is the annihilation and destruction of Jerusalem, of Israel." Verse 6. The tabernacles of Edom and the Ishmaelites of Moab and the Hagarenes, Gebel and Ammon and Amalek, the Philistines and the inhabitants of Tyre, Asser, Iraq, also is joined with him. They have helped the children of Lot. The children of Lot, who've fallen away, even though they were brothers of Abraham. "Do unto them as unto Midian, as unto Sisera, as to Jabin at the brook Kishon, where they were utterly destroyed, and Sin was destroyed." That's a separate account. "Which perished at Endor, they became as dung of the earth. Make their nobles like Oreb and like Zeb. Yea, all their princes are Zebra and Zalmunna, men and peoples who Gideon destroyed, who worship false gods, who said, 'Let us take to ourselves the houses of God in possession.'" As Israel gets wealthier and stronger, does that reduce their resolve to overthrow Israel? As Israel gets stronger and wealthier, their perpetual hatred and bitterness grows day by day by day. And they say, "We will drive them into the sea." However, verse 16. "Fill their faces with shame, that they may seek thy name, O Yahweh. Let them be confounded in trouble forever. Yea, let them be put to shame and perish, that men may know that thou, whose name alone is Jehovah, is Yahweh, art the Most High over all the earth." The Lord Jesus will come back, and ultimately the battle of the houses of Esau and Jacob will be put to rest at the return of the Son of God. Let's look forward to that day with joy in our hearts. Thank you.